Welcome to the Holiness Today podcast. Earlier this month, I connected with recently elected General Superintendent T. Scott Daniels. In our conversation, he tells of his journey of faith, how God has used him in ministry, and what his hope is for the Church of the Nazarene. Dr. Daniels, I'm going to start us off borrowing something that you prompt your guests on your New Creation Conversations podcast.
All right.
Can you tell us about your journey, your faith journey, your ministerial journey, and your academic journey?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in a family of ministers. My great-grandmothers on both sides, on my mom's side and my dad's side, were really the pillars of faith, both in similar ways. They both lost daughters in childhood, and their grief led them to find the church, or the church find them. And so they were our entree, not just into faith really, but also into the Church of Nazarene. But each of them had sons remaining. And so on the Daniels side, there were two sons left. And on my mom's maiden name is Carpenter, there were three sons left on that side. And all five of them found their way into ministry. And so the two oldest, Harold Daniels and Melvin Carpenter, my two grandfathers, both became ministers in the Church of Nazarene at very young ages. And the next generation, my mom and dad and their sisters and brothers, all either were Nazarene ministers or married Nazarene ministers. And so for two generations above me, it's the only thing anybody did. And so most of my childhood then was our vacations were going to camp meetings or following my dad. My dad had a really beautiful singing voice, and so he would often lead worship at camp meetings, and my grandfather would preach. And so, you know, a lot of my memories are of church-related things growing up. And it was at a camp meeting where my dad was doing music and my grandfather was preaching as a seven-year-old that I accepted Christ. I don't remember what my grandfather preached on. What I do remember is my grandmother was trying to keep me quiet with fruit-flavored lifesavers all through the service. But at the end, he said, you know, somebody needs to pray. And I was sure it was me. And so, you know, I really, I loved the church growing up. And almost all of the successful things in my life and beautiful things in my life, in one way or another, we're connected to the local church and to the people that I knew growing up. And certainly growing up in a pastor's home, I knew there were challenges and there were, problem people at times, but it was, you know, it was really home, and it was, and I loved it. And as a 17-year-old, all that to say though, I really thought maybe I should do something else. Everybody in my family are ministers. Maybe I could do something else with my life. And so I wanted to be a sports journalist. I was kind of, we lived in Seattle mostly. My mom and dad pastored for 20 years there. And when we moved there, the Mariners were about 2 years old, and they were so bad that they would send my dad a clergy pass every year. And so it was like having season tickets. So we saw a bad baseball in the old kingdom in Seattle for years. But I got a job with Seattle Pacific University's basketball team. And when I was in eighth grade doing stats for their radio broadcast, and I did that all through high school. And I just thought, that's what I want to do. I was not a good athlete, but I loved good athletes. And so, but I got to World Youth Congress, was now NYC in Mexico in 83. And some friends invited me to sit towards the front with them one night. And Stephen Manley was preaching out of John about where I am, there my servant shall be also. And the only part of the sermon I remember is he was saying something to the effect of, sometimes we try to reverse that and say, I'm going to go over here, God, come with me. But this is where God is, where Christ is. That's where disciples should be. And I was really deeply convicted that I wasn't a bad kid. I wasn't doing bad things necessarily, but I was creating my life and inviting God to bless it rather than asking God what he wanted me to do. And so I'm not all that, not all that spiritualistic, but I left out there that night kind of feeling deeply impressed about two things. I was supposed to go into ministry, And I was supposed to come to NNC and now NNU. At the time, I was really resisting that because growing up in Seattle, big city kid, we would come visit NNU out here in the sticks. Now I live here, but in Nampa, and, you know, it was a town of about 25,000 in those days. And, you know, it was just kind of a farmland. And I just thought, that's a huge town. I'm not going there. But so I took up my cross and moved and came to Idaho for college. But you know, God really blessed that. And then kind of the only other twist in the story, other than meeting Debbie after I graduated, and she, you know, did not grow up in a Christian home and had come to Christ at 22. And so we've been an interesting team in ministry, the church kid and the unchurched kid, finding their way in ministry together. But I really didn't expect to become an academic. I started at Fuller Seminary on accident. I went home to be my dad's youth minister, and Fuller had an extension program in town and I could get started. But I kind of fell in love with the courses. I had to move to campus. I was the last class where you had to spend a year in Pasadena. And so, yeah, so I went down there and I had a friend convince me I should stay and keep doing doctoral work. But at the time I just thought, oh, I'll just, people have to call me doctor and maybe I'll write a few books along the right way. But I didn't expect to teach. But kind of invitation to teach one semester, and just kind of fell in love with that world. And so the other part of the unexpected journey is just spending 30, almost 35 years kind of in two places, both the university and the church. But that's kind of my journey, a little bit of my journey.
So you were ordained in 91?
I think it was 92. I think 92.
92, okay.
Yeah.
And then so you were studying full-time and pastoring full-time.
Well, kind of. I graduated from NNU in 88, and I immediately started into the MDiv program, but just part-time. I was taking a couple of Fuller was on quarters. I think they may still be, but I was taking a couple of classes a quarter to try to get my MDiv done. And so I finished my MDiv in 92. So the same, I finished my MDiv and got ordained within just a few weeks of each other, if I remember correctly, in 92.
Okay.
And then... and then moved straight into the PhD program in 92. I was on staff part-time at Pasadena First in those days. Once we moved to Pasadena, I became the college pastor at PASNAS. And so we were there till 96. I'd finished my coursework. I was teaching at Azusa Pacific. I hadn't finished my dissertation, and Azusa really liked me and wanted me to stay. And offered me a full contract. And the day after they offered it to me, I got a call from SNU and they had an opening. And so I kind of put APU on hold, and we interviewed with SNU and ended up, I really wanted to be in one of our schools. And so we moved to Oklahoma in 96, and I was there till 2002. And in 2002 was when I was pulpit supplying for Richardson, just outside of Dallas, the church in Richardson, kind of every other week through the summer during their interim. And by the end of the summer, they said, hey, we've been interviewing people, but every week you're here, people say, why don't we just get him to stay? And so summer, I said, yeah, I've been thinking that same thing too. So yeah, so we transitioned in 92. And so it's been Richardson, Pasadena First, and then College Church, 21 years of being a lead pastor with a little bit of my last 5 years in Pasadena, APU talked me into coming back and being the dean of their school of theology. And so somewhere I've been adjuncting almost every semester during those 21 years or teaching full time. So what my friends call my suicide mission was my 5 years at PASNAS, where I was the lead pastor at PASNAS, but also the dean of the school of theology. It was fun, but those were the 5 years that about did me in.
So in those early days when you were getting going in your graduate school, did you feel that you were going to be a full-time professor, full-time, or did you even really kind of think out your 10-year plan or your life plan at that point in time?
No, when I went to seminary, I thought my primary gifts are in preaching. That was the some extent of my imagination was what it meant to be a pastor. And I enjoyed youth ministry, but I thought, well, I won't do that very long. I'll be a lead pastor somewhere. I think, you know, it's interesting looking back. There were a number of people in my generation that graduated somewhere in the 80s or early 90s. So when I was a student at NNU back in the 80s, almost everybody on faculty had doctor of ministry degrees. I think there was only one faculty member with a PhD. And there were a whole bunch of us. And I think some of it was some of the philosophical shifts that were going on at the time. I think there were some tensions in evangelicalism that was happening in the 80s and 90s. There were a bunch of us that got to seminary, and it was almost like, I will do whatever it takes to keep this conversation going. Because as soon as I go to the local church, I'll have to have a different sphere of discourse. And I'm not ready for that. I'll do whatever it takes to keep this conversation going. I tell people, it was my first class at Fuller on campus where I heard the word postmodern for the first time, right? And it was kind of like, there was just all this stuff in the air about what's going on culturally and theologically right now. And there were a bunch of us. I mean, there are a bunch of people my age who stayed in school too long and ended up getting PhDs in those generations. And if you look at our schools of theology right now, you'd see the reverse, that the majority of people teaching in our universities and seminary right now have PhDs. And then there's some doctor of ministry people with a good deal of ministry experience, but went on and did a doctoral degree in ministry. That was the exception, and now it's kind of the rule. And so I was kind of part of that wave of whatever was happening at that time that said, I don't know if I mean to be a teacher, but I want to keep this conversation going.
And your research area was Christian ethics and theology, is that right? So what did you land on? It's hard to not go down rabbit trails when you're doing research, but.
So I kind of chose theology and ethics because of really three professors at Fuller that I had that first quarter when I got there. I had a woman named Nancy Murphy, who is an amazing philosophical theologian. And I just thought, man, that scratches my itch in terms of philosophy. I had Miroslav Volf, who now teaches at Yale, but was an incredible theologian. But then Richard Mao was the provost at the time at Fuller and became the president the next year. And so he was the ethicist. And I just thought he was the best teacher I'd ever had. And so I started stalking him. And the thing I loved about ethics was it was theology, it was philosophy, and it had some practical aspects of ministry related to it. And so it was great. He accepted me as his student, and I got to work as his research assistant. And I learned a lot actually about academic administration. I knew nothing about academic administration, but working those years in the president's office with them, he's continued to be a dear friend and mentor across the years. But I was really interested, and if I could do it over again, I would probably write my dissertation solely on somebody like Jacques Ellul. I'd learn French, and I would, because I was interested in his work. But I was really interested. This was, the internet was new. People were asking all these questions about what is spiritual formation and character formation going to look like in the light of this upcoming online age? And what will this do to church? What will this do to worship? One of my real friends in life is Jamie Smith, James K. Smith at Calvin, and he really did he did what I was trying to do best. In desiring the kingdom, I was really thinking about how does worship form character, and what will and practices matter, and so what will happen. And so, without going too deep down a rabbit hole, I came to the hearty conclusion that yes, these changes will have an impact, but they don't have to be negative. There were people like Neil Postman and Jacques Ellul who were very, very suspicious of these changes. But then there's a guy named Walter Ong who was talking about how, as great as the literate age was, there were aspects of the oral age that were lost. And so much of the biblical culture has to do with orality and with storytelling and with forming people through story. And Ong was kind of hopeful that an image related age could recover some. I mean, it certainly has some scary aspects to it. I was kind of I was making an apology for it doesn't all have to be bad. There may be ways for us to recapture narrative, recapture storytelling in an image centered age. And I think some of that has come to be. it certainly has some big downsides. And but so that's kind of what I wrote about and researched about, or those three people, Postman Ong and Jacques Ellul, and basically put them in a room and had them have a conversation with each other.
So is there any one thinker or book that kind of, as you were studying your PhD program, that set you on worship and ethics, that kind of got you on that journey, that thought journey? Or
yeah, it's not related to worship. Although, you know, Robert Weber and Marv Adon and some of those people were writing on worship. And I'm not being facetious when I say Jamie and I became friends, and Jamie really did write the stuff that I think I point to and say, I'm just poor man's Jamie Smith now. I mean, he really has shaped my thinking in what he did in the trilogy. But really, the person who made me kind of freak out academically, and probably is the reason I got stuck in ethics, was I had never heard of Stanley Hauerwas prior to going to seminary. And somebody gave me a copy of Resident Aliens early on in seminary, he and Will Willimon's book. And that just kind of, it was almost like somebody saying clear, like it was a restarting of my whole kind of theological framework and shock into a whole thing. And so it was really Hauerwas's work on character and how character is formed. His great book, A Community of Character, I've probably read 8 times. I was along that time where Hauerwas was kind of exploding. And then later, I was already done with my PhD, but you know, N.T. Wright's just messed me up in all sorts of ways in terms of the ways that Paul thinks and theological formation happens for the early church.
He kind of had that effect on everyone, I think, in the theological world, huh?
Yeah, I remember I was at an American Academy of Religion Society of Biblical Literature meeting long time ago, and Steve Green, who had been my pastor at Pasadena First and a really important mentor in my life, and then came to teach at SNU, just recently retired, but he was there. And I remember him running into me and he said, "Scott, have you ever heard the name N.T. Wright?" And I hadn't. And he said, "I just went to hear a paper. I think I may have either heard the smartest person in the world," or he said, "I don't think he's Jesus, but I would sell everything and follow him right now." I forget what year it was. It was a long time ago, but it was like his work was emerging on the scene, and then all of a sudden it exploded, and everybody had heard of N.T. Wright. Yeah.
That's funny. I'll get in trouble if I don't ask this question, but can you tell the story about how you met your wife, Debbie? I've read the story. I've heard the story. It doesn't get old. I told my wife the story the other day and she loved it.
Yeah. So it was in November. In fact, we kind of have a birthday party every year. The second Sunday of November in 1988, she got off, I think it was Thursday or Friday that week, she got off the wrong exit on the freeway and drove by the Seattle Aurora Church. And we had just a few months before finished the new sanctuary, and it's a really beautiful building. And she thought, "Oh man, that's beautiful. I should go to church sometime," and really had not in her life. And she saw a couple of guys holding up a sign. And we don't remember ever hanging up a sign. So we joked there were a couple of angels hiding behind a telephone pole saying, "Here she comes, here she comes." But they had the wrong time. Either that or she read the wrong time. She came about 30-45 minutes after Sunday school had already started. And so a wonderful woman named Dolly Kirkheide, an elderly lady at church who worked as a greeter, met her at the door and just kind of showed her around the church, talked to her about her life, invited her to sit with them. And crazy, but she gave her life to the Lord that first Sunday. She felt like the sermon was directed right at her. We laughed that when my dad opened the altar, she had no idea what that was. In fact, was a little fearful that we might sacrifice a chicken or something up there. But thankfully, he paused and explained what the altar was, and she came forward. Kind of crazy for the little bit of context that she had about church and faith. She knew something had radically changed in her life. And in fact, it started to really create upheaval in her. She was engaged at the time and was just a few months from getting married. It created this big upheaval in that relationship, and they ended up breaking up. And his parents thought she had joined a cult. And she just started coming to singles Bible study and fact, a dear friend of ours here was the person who bought her her first Bible. And anyway, we met about 6 months later. A friend of mine worked at the television station Debbie was working at, and they met and realized they went to the same church. And my friend sat on the second row, and Debbie always sat in the back. So I was on the platform. Those were the days where all the staff had to sit on the platform. And so in she walked in this leather miniskirt and tights and saddle shoes. I just thought it was the cutest person I'd ever seen. And I leaned over to my dad. I was sitting next to him. I said, "Who is the girl in the second row with the leather miniskirt?" I said, "You know, anybody who's spiritual enough to sit in the second row, but wild enough to wear a leather miniskirt to church, that may be the girl for me." And so I immediately after the service was over, I was desperate. All my friends were junior hires at this point. I ran straight down and introduced myself and invited her to come to church with me that night. We were having a teen thing, and she was funny. She so knew the church, she thought Sunday night was just a repeat of what we did Sunday morning for people who could be there Sunday morning. Yeah. So, but the rest is kind of history. We got married a year later. Like, we fell in love fast. And so some days I marvel at God's graciousness to, you know, really, for her to have come from very little church background to, man, within a year or two, we are in Pasadena, in the throes of living on campus at seminary. She's attending dinners with me with some of the greatest scholars, theological and biblical scholars in the world. So, I mean, within about a 3 or 4 year period, I mean, talk about being thrown in the deep end, let alone marrying into this tribe of Levites. So she's been amazing and a real breath of fresh air in our family. But I've told people, I mentioned it earlier, I think God in his providence made us a really interesting team in ministry. Even when we were a youth ministry, I understood the kid who grew up in the church and thought and was kind of bored. And I knew how to speak to them and meet them. Those kids made her mad, frankly, because she felt like they had been given an advantage she didn't have and they would frustrate her. But she totally understood the kid who came from the broken home, single mom, kind of life like hers, who couldn't find Genesis. And she just knew how to meet those kids and introduce them to Jesus. And so anyway, and that's kind of continued on into adults and church life. And yeah, so she's great.
Did she ever ask you questions that you just kind of had blown past and caused you to think about theology afresh or anything like that? Or
we were reading the Bible together and you know, there's nothing scarier than somebody reading the Bible for the first time and having all these questions about tent pegs through foreheads and other kind of wild things, you know, that happen. I did have a funny thing that happened. I was trying to teach her early on when we were dating. I was trying to teach her the books of the Bible, just how to find stuff. And my job on Sunday mornings was to read one of the scripture texts. And so I had gotten a note from somebody who had asked me when I announced the text that we're going to read to give them more time to find it. And so I got up one Sunday and it was like Habakkuk or some obscure text. And so I said, you know, the text this morning's from Obadiah. It's back in the Minor Prophets. I'll give you some time to find it. And then, you know, just dumb 23-year-old thought comes through my head. I said, in fact, because I was thinking about Debbie and how long it was going to take her to find it. I said, in fact, if you want to, you could race your neighbor for a quarter to see who could find the text fastest. And so the next Sunday, if you remember Nate, friendship and worship cards that were always in the rack, which I always joke, I've never seen one that was friendly or worshipful, but I got a friendship and worship card the next week that said, "We've been praying you would be more respectful in the pulpit, and now you're encouraging gambling." So it was fun. It was fun to see. I think more than the questions, what was so exciting and dynamic about her faith was God had really transformed her. And there was just this real, genuine, simplistic faith that said, if we pray about this, God will do this. And I think more than the biblical questions was the challenges to my faith to say, do I really believe the stuff that we talk about? Because she was putting God to the test quite frequently. Are we going to take this leap of faith? Yeah.
So just briefly, tell us how many kids you have, what they're doing, where they're at in life.
Yeah, we've had four children, three sons and a daughter at the end. Our oldest, Caleb, is married to a wonderful young woman named Mel. They're both 29. Caleb finished his MDiv here at NNU and got ordained 2 or 3 years ago. Teaches Bible at an evangelical Friends Christian school here in Idaho. And Mel is a counselor at an elementary school. Noah, our second son, got ordained 2 years ago, and his wife, Carrie, they live here too. Noah works at NNU and is the coordinates all the worship for chapel and prepares all the summer travel groups to be ready in the summer. He's a really good worship leader, but he's working on his MDiv right now, trying to finish that up here at NNU too. Jonah, our third son, just got married in the spring. Wonderful wife, Perry. Jonah has every adolescent kid's dream job. Jonah is a video game tester, and they love him, and he loves his job. And Perry works with my wife at the local Christian Credit Union. And then Sophie, our youngest, will be a senior this year at NNU, and she's a nursing major. So that's where they are and what they're doing.
So you got two in the family business so far, is that
two
right?
In the family business so far, yeah, that's right. No grandkids, and we're impatiently waiting.
Right. So how many generations is that for our listeners in the Church of the Nazarene for you?
Well, it's four. It's four. And you know, many of my cousins in that third generation, I think there are 12 of us. I think eight or nine of us are ordained. And so they're the fourth generation carrying some of that forward. Although on my grandma Daniel's side, we joke, we haven't found the end of the line of ministers. It goes back to Methodist circuit riders. And so I'm either the 12th or 13th, which would make them either the 13th or 14th generation. Wow. On that side. So yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, it is, God has been faithful to that
lineage. Great legacy. So a question I've gotten from different people, are you going to be relocating to Kansas? I know the answer, but for our listeners, can you let them know?
Well, I was just there for a whole week, and it was the sweatiest week I've ever experienced. I am not moving to Kansas.
Not moving to Kansas.
No, I don't know when the policy rules changed for general superintendents, but I think it was about a decade ago where the policy was made that general superintendents can live anywhere within the continental U.S. that they want to live, as long as you can get to an airport quickly. And I think COVID especially, and moving us to, you know, these kind of Zoom conversations, has made it possible for that to happen. And so, yeah, this has been a crazy transition. I can't imagine what it would have been like to try to sell a house and move to Lenexa or Lake
for sure.
Or somewhere. But yeah, at least currently the plan is for us to stay here. My dad passed away 3 years ago. My mom's a block and a half away, and all four kids are here. So it would have been a killer to leave.
And the humidity, of course.
Yeah. And the humidity. I'm going to start with kids are nice, but the humidity is terrible.
Yeah. So you were a week here in Kansas. Tell us a little bit about that. There's a great picture going around of first day at GS training on Facebook. So did your daughter make that for you? Is that my understanding?
Yeah, we kind of joked about it. We had joked about calling. I started calling it GS school.
GS school. That's say, right. Yeah. School.
Yeah. When do you have to go? When do you start? And I would say, well, I start the first week of August because I got to go to GS school. And so people got tickled that I kept calling it that. And so Sophie said, hey, we should make you, she goes, I have that little board with it. I'll make you a first day of school sign. And, Yeah, but it's really, I don't know. I don't know what we're calling it now, boot camp or...
that's what Dr. Busey called it, right? Boot camp. Or,
yeah, GS boot camp. Yeah, we met for a week. I think it was really important. The four remaining general superintendents, I think both Gustavo and Philly both had district assemblies still going on, and we're trying to wrap that up. And so I saw Philly briefly, but they were both somewhere else in the world most of the week. But because Carla was the current chair, and so they transitioned from being the so for people who aren't familiar, the six of us get divided for 2-year periods of time over different jurisdictions. And One of those jurisdictions, one of those two-year periods, you serve as the chair of the Board of General Superintendents. And so you still have jurisdiction over a couple of the fields, educational fields in USA and Canada, but you don't have international jurisdiction during those 2 years. But you have a lot of work because you oversee all this stuff locally. But Carla has been that, and David was transitioning to become, is now the serving chair. And so it just made sense for them to be kind of the instructors. And so a little bit of it was probably a couple of full days with them, kind of talking through what to do and what not to do when you are presiding over district assemblies, and what are some of the kind of our theology of ordination and how to do ordinations well. Some of the, you know, some of the challenges and decisions that you make as general superintendent, how we work together as a board. It's unique because all of us came from some kind of lead pastorate or academic administrative role, or Christian was a regional director, where you know you really had sole authority over something, but now you're working as a team of six. And so we talked through a lot of those dynamics and the uniqueness of that. I think David, I can't remember who David borrowed the concept from, but he was talking about in our work together, the goal is to kind of find the seventh general superintendent, to find our uniquenesses. We bring all of our uniquenesses around the table, but we're looking for that cohesive voice that comes out of those conversations together. But then two or three of the days, we're just, you know, meeting with folks like you and folks who meet, you know, all the different, that was kind of overwhelming part, frankly. It was just all the moving parts that make up the Church of the Nazarene and all the different departments and different really gifted people leading all those different places. And at some level, they have their own autonomy, but at some level, they also come into contact with the Board of General Superintendents. And so just kind of figuring out how the whole big global church functions is really fascinating. I still have a big learning curve to go, but that was really a fun part
So what was the, if you can share it with us, what was the biggest surprise that you were kind of surprised to learn, or just the fullness of seeing it?
I don't know that anything was overly surprising other than I think I was pleasantly surprised at the overall health of the denomination right now. I think sometimes when you're out on the periphery and not in the day-to-day stuff, you hear about there's some significant challenges going on. And I joke with people, the difference between my life about 5 weeks ago and now is things happened in the church and I usually would hear about them 3 weeks after they happened and about third hand and largely, you know, inaccurate tellings of what happened. Now I have all the documents. I know what's going on.
They came to you with that big black binder and showed you how it really was.
Huh? Yeah, that's right. And emails come daily and regularly. And so there's certainly some challenges and some really difficult things happening in various corners of the denomination. And I think a lot of times we rightly pay attention to that and focus on that. And I think even coming out of General Assembly, some of the angst over some of the divisions within the church certainly have dominated some of our conversation. But I was just pleasantly surprised, Nate, at how just department by department, there have certainly been a number of changes and transitions, and some of them forced by the challenges of the last 10 years. But just overall, the health of global missions, the health of even through the transitions that you guys have had to go through at the Foundry and with publishing with Holiness Today, but still kind of coming out in a different way, but coming out in a really healthy, hopeful way. And our, you know, education institutions are going through transition, but there's a lot of hope and optimism there too. And a lot of really good, healthy things happening. And so that I left pleasantly surprised. I won't say I expected to kind of leave burdened, but that's what people want to say to you, man, now that you know everything, it must be so weighty on you. And I was like, actually, no, I came out, wow, this is really, like, there's some serious challenges, but there's a lot of things to be really hopeful about as well.
And where will you be first traveling to? Where's your first district assembly? Tell us a little about your travels upcoming. And when do you start traveling?
My first 2 years of jurisdiction are South America and the Tribeca field. And so I start traveling to do district assemblies in late October, about October 20th or so, 2021. And so I have three separate trips to South America, four if you count the Global Theology Conference in Argentina this year too, but three in terms of traveling for a long period of time for district assemblies. So it's essentially October, November, and then January and March. Every time I go to South America, I don't go for less than 3 weeks, but I don't go for longer than four. So it's about 24, 25 days each time. And it's fun, you know, in district assembly after district assembly. That will be a unique challenge. I bought a Babbel app and I'm working on my my Spanish and my Portuguese, but I'm not going, you know, I'll need a translator badly, but at least I'll be able to function a bit.
So not switching gears, but going back to something you said right after you got elected, you said you've been inspired by William Greathouse's leadership of bringing theological coherence to the BGS. How do you see that kind of inspiration manifesting in your new role? You've done that as a pastor, kind of bridging the gap between the academy and the pew. How do you see yourself doing that as a general superintendent going forward?
Yeah, I think the Greathouse comparison for me, or the sense of whatever mantle that is that Greathouse carried uniquely as a general superintendent. And I kind of thought if I get elected, it will be, I think at least in part, some of the people who will be voting for me are people who are concerned about that gap that happens sometimes between the academy and the local church. And we are in a moment where there are a number of significant social and theological issues at work. And at times, unfortunately, the church struggles to trust some of the people who've done the longest and most detailed work in some of those areas to help at least be part of that conversation. And I say that saying, I don't know that we should have a magisterium that makes all of the theological decisions that's made up only of people who serve in the academies. But I've also been in moments and conversations where it feels like we are going to have conversation and think about and try to address these kinds of issues, but we're going to exclude those people. We're only going to include lay people and local church pastors who absolutely, and international leaders who absolutely should be at the table and be in that part of that conversation. But I'm also often troubled by how we exclude then some of the folks from the academy in some of those conversations. And so certainly I want to be a bridge the way that I feel like Greathouse was a scholar with a really deep pastoral heart for the local church. And I think one of the really beautiful parts of the Church of the Nazarene's history has been our emphasis on education and the universities, seminary, Bible colleges that we have created. And I would hate for us to lose that as part of the deep DNA of our tradition. And so I want to advocate for that. But then at the same time too, there is a need for us to continue to reflect on historically who we've been and find that theological coherence that's at the core of who we are. At M17 or one of those M's back there, I was asked to speak about theological coherence, and I told what I think is kind of a mythical story about the farmer who meets New Zealand sheep herders who said, we don't have many walls because we dig such deep wells. And so this conversation of wells versus fences became kind of an important thing. And I want to emphasize that. It's not that we can live without walls, but it is, what are the deep wells, especially in a tradition like ours, Nate, that really, although we had people who left Methodism or the Quakers or some other group to join us, for the most part, we were just people who had great differences, but had some really common core values that led us to unity. And so I don't want us to lose that. And so how can we continue to articulate what those deep wells are and trust each other and be friends across some of our differences? So we'll see. But that's the part of Great House that I just adored and loved. And yeah, and his ability to do that without kind of going to war with people.
Yeah,
but sure. He had that kind of gentle, loving presence, but also very, very committed to truth and very committed to laying those things out. So
if you were a pastor starting out in ministry today, what would you give yourself? Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to a young pastor that's going into the ministry?
There's a wonderful book out there called The First 100 Days, and I would buy that. I would get that on Amazon. I think the biggest mistake, and I do talk about it in 100 days, but I think the mistake that oftentimes we make when we enter into ministry is we forget the people that were called to pastor have their own history. And what we end up doing is we end up coming in and thinking we're going to rescue these people from something, and or everything that happened before us wasn't very important, but now, you know, now the good days have arrived. I find it too infrequent that leaders have that ability to enter into a place that has a history and know how to understand that history, but then help them move forward, not necessarily bow the knee to that history, but at the same time, be able to move that forward. And then I think also that delicate balance between helping us be shaped by the history and identity of who we are as a denomination and treasure that, lean into that, support that, while at the same time being able to be very contextual to where a congregation is and meet the unique needs. It feels like we have these kind of two tensions. We're either kind of super denominational, or we are radically independent, and we kind of look at the landscape these days and say, wow, man, the independents have all the fun, and they have no parameters. They can kind of make up stuff and do whatever they want to, and they seem to do really well. Well, now I think 20, 30 years into the big growth of the independent church movement, we also now get to see some of the downsides of that, though. Some of the lack of accountability, some difficulties of those movements making transitions. And somewhere in there, the via media of Wesleyanism, somewhere in there is that ability to really treasure being part of a connectional tradition while also finding ways to be uniquely contextual in the unique place that God has called you and the unique ministries that are in front of you. So figuring out how to do that. And so I always want to say to young pastors, man, find ways to stay connected to the denomination, but then also, be in your neighborhood and figure out who are these people that God has called you to here. And it's kind of, I also think we're in an age where, and we're, you know, this is kind of ironic since we're posting a podcast, but we could spend less time pontificating on social media and being present with people. Some of the people, I feel like we spend a lot of time obsessing about some things that frustrate us and make us mad. And so I found myself constantly down kind of the dark rabbit hole of social media. And every once in a while I thought I should turn this off and go visit my sick friend at the hospital or go
call him. Go see someone in person, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Do some ministry. Yeah.
Right. So kind of on that note, what has been, I mean, probably social media would be up there, but what has been your probably biggest challenge in ministry through your life of ministry? Maybe still is a big challenge for you. And then also, what has been your greatest joy?
Yeah, the challenge has been learning how to discern what God is preparing you for. And this may be me. I had to take my strengths again when I was with you guys last week. And, achiever is a mess for me. And so Debbie and I have laughed that, and she has achiever in her top five too. So we joke that almost every dinner we've had together, at some point we ask, where do we see ourselves in 10 years? You know, where do we want to go? And so I think I've always had this sense of allowing the moment to be a form of preparation for whatever God's going to do for us in the future. It's weird turning 57 and then having a role like general superintendent where I think this time I mean it. This is probably my last job, right? Like, I feel like I'm not sure I'm still preparing for what's out in the future, while being really present to the current moment. And maybe that's just my unique challenge, but it's been, how can I embrace the beauty of this current group of people, what God is doing in this present circumstance, and not get so obsessed with what is coming next, or how do I prepare for this, or how do we, and even local church wise, how do we think about growing and maximize, and maximizing what God is doing here, while not losing just the beauty of the reality of having people that you're pastoring with and getting to share life with each other. And that really answers what's the best part. The joy is all the text messages that I received that Thursday that I got elected from people in all sorts of churches, like everywhere, and just people along the journey who your life has interacted with them. Children that you dedicated as babies that you get to also officiate their wedding, that's really a joy of ministry. And I tell people the thing my dad was best at, and I hope I have a lot of that part of him in me, is my dad would say to me all the time things like, isn't this cool? Like we have to come to church every Sunday, but other people don't, and they still show up, right? And they support the ministry of the church, and they love us and make this kind of calling that we have possible. And so it never became a sense of obligation or a sense that he was an entitlement is the better term, but living with a deep sense of gratitude for what's going on. And so I really am. And I think that's what last week was an affirmation to, just really deep sense of gratitude for this particular tradition that raised me and educated me and has given me places to serve, and the people that have loved us and we've had a chance to love along the way.
So in all the places you've served, all the colleges you've been to, everywhere you've been in the Church of Nazarene, which place makes the best cup of coffee?
Well,
I've had bad church coffee, so I don't have to give bad examples. The best.
Yeah, coffee. Well, that's the home of snobby coffee is Seattle. So
Seattle.
Yeah, you can't have bad church coffee in Seattle, or people leave.
That's good to know. No. So even the churches in Seattle have good coffee.
Oh my word! Yes, yeah, they're snobs. Yes.
Well, that, are you good for some rapid fire questions, just to sure. get to know your questions?
Sure.
All right. What is your favorite color?
Blue.
Favorite flavor of ice cream?
Chocolate chip cookie dough.
What are you most afraid of?
At my thing at this, they had a reception for Christian and me, and they asked me that question, and I can't remember what I answered, but afterwards I thought, oh, I know what my greatest fear is. My greatest fear in this job is people keep asking me, are you a picky eater? And I am not. So my greatest fear is gaining 20 pounds in this job as I travel around and get to meet all these different people. Yeah, that's my greatest fear.
All right. Favorite genre of music? or band?
Oh, 70s. Yeah, 70s classic rock.
Okay, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Favorite?
Yeah, the Eagles.
The Eagles, okay. Anytime. All right. Favorite movie?
It's terrible to say Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but that is my favorite film. But my favorite serious film is probably Shawshank Redemption, in terms of, you know, deep, thoughtful themes of things. But yeah.
All right. Favorite work of nonfiction other than the Bible?
Probably something like Eugene Peterson's The Pastor, or I love reading so many great scholars. Phil Yancey's memoir was incredible, and so was Eugene Peterson. So I love reading memoirs.
Favorite work of fiction?
The Brothers Karamazov.
If the Nazarene Church did not exist, what denomination would you find yourself in?
Probably either an evangelical friend or a conservative Methodist. I don't know, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Do you have pets?
We do. I don't know that I've ever had a day in my life that I didn't own a dog. And so I have a golden doodle sitting on my feet right now as we're having this conversation. Henley, who is attached at the hip with me. When we moved to Idaho, for some reason, my wife got into raising rabbits. And so we have rabbits also. I'm deathly allergic to cats, so I'm a dog person.
Do you have a gold doodle because of allergies as well? Is that the hypoallergenic side of that? Or
yeah, it helps. It helps. I'm not allergic to dogs, though, although I'm not a big fan of shedding. Yeah, but growing up, my mom, who hated dog hair, would only allow us to have miniature schnauzers because they didn't shed. But we had a big, when the kids were little, we had a big shepherd, kind of a lab shepherd mix. And we joked, she was like having Nana from Peter Pan. Like she just cared for, if the kids were crying, she would come and wake us up if the baby was crying, and she would sleep right beside their crib. Like she was just the perfect dog. And so the thing I love about the whole doodle thing is Henley has the size and temperament of a golden retriever, but she doesn't shed. Like it's the best of both worlds. It's the best of both worlds. Yeah. But I love that because, you know, there's nothing better than the kind of Labrador retriever personality of a dog. Like they just are
always happy to see you.
Yeah. Yeah. And just
probably would be kind to a thief as well.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You feel a little secure when your daughter's home alone or whatever, but yeah.
All right. So here's one that might take a little bit of thought. You might have it right away. But if you could have dinner with any three historical characters, not in the Bible, who would you choose and why?
Not in the Bible. This sounds strange. I'm for some reason, maybe it's just because I loved McCullough's biography of John Adams, but I'm a big John Adams fan. I would probably you got to put John Wesley in that dinner. Yeah, I'd probably get fired if you don't include John Wesley there. Let me think, who's a good third one? Let's add Mildred Bangs Wynkoop into that table too. We'll get Mildred there too. All right,
your favorite book of the Bible.
That's everybody in my congregation just shouted Exodus at the top of their lungs when they heard that question. I find myself constantly going back to Exodus and preaching because I just think the deliverance of the people from slavery is the paradigm of salvation for the rest of the scripture. But Exodus itself, after the event, the book itself gets kind of boring. But you know that I'm a big Jonah fan for a little. Book. I love Jonah. But probably my favorite, I'm going to go with, you know, Revelation and the New Testament, but also I'm a big advocate for the Gospel of Mark. I've done a lot of work on the Gospel of Mark, and in part because thanks to Augustine, Mark got overlooked for so much of church history because Augustine just thought it was like the pocket-sized version of Matthew. But Mark was probably the earliest of the Gospels, and it's fascinating and unique. And so we'll go with Mark.
So on that note, do you, what book do you think you'll be preaching from? Do they give you kind of a guidance on what you'll be preaching on as you go into your district assemblies, or do you get to kind of have some leeway there?
If there is guidance, they didn't deal with it.
That didn't come up in the training.
I would like some guidance, but I think we have some relative freedom to preach what we feel like God's leading us to preach on in those moments. Certainly, I think the discipleship journey that we've been talking about as a denomination for the last 10 years or so, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, there's encouragement to keep people going along that journey of grace. Apart from that, no, I have general autonomy. So I'm trying to decide. It's a big question. Since I have Trevecca and Dan and Denise Boone are such good friends, we've been teasing each other about whether I'm going to get one really good ordination sermon and preach it over and over again.
Yeah.
Or change it up for their sake so they don't have to sit through it.
Same one, right?
Yeah. 14 different times. Yeah.
That's funny.
I am going to try. I have a goal to write 3 or 4 really good sermons and have them translated into Spanish and Portuguese and see if I can work on my pronunciation so I can at least
a
couple of sermons without translation. So we'll see how that goes.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
That'd be great. All right. These questions are for your listeners and your students. Are you going to still do the New Creations podcast, Conversations podcast as a general, and are you still going to teach?
Yes, I hope to keep the New Creation Conversations podcast going. I'm on a little bit of a break. I got behind with everything going on this summer. But IVP and Baker and Brazos and a couple other publishers have sent me some stuff recently. So I need to line up some conversations. But my goal is to keep that going. I am teaching this first semester at NTS, the classes that I was planning to teach initially, since it was so late. And, I'm going to have to figure out some ways to do it. But and I'm going to hopefully have a good TA. But we'll see. This first semester, Nate, is kind of an experiment to see.
Yeah, for sure.
What I have the space to do. I would love to do that at least once a year if I can. I really enjoy, last year I taught the Life and Theology of John Wesley course for NTS. And I really had a fun time doing that. And so I'd kind of like to make, if they're okay with that, we've been talking about just making that course mine and teaching it once a year, but we'll see if I have the space to do that. I'm teaching also history and polity this semester. And it's kind of funny to have a general superintendent teaching history and polity, but it may be good for me. I may learn some things from the manual.
Learn it as you're teaching it. That's good. All right. Closing question for you. What is your hope, prayer, blessing for the Church of Nazarene, or even just the global ecumenical church in the 21st century? That's a big question. That's a $1 million question, but what has God placed on your heart going into this ministry?
Yeah, I hope, as we've talked about, to be a bridge in the tensions that I think are going on in North America and to some degree Europe as well. But I hope people who are Nazarenes really do appreciate how unique this experiment of trying to be a globally connected church is. I mean, and it really is very, very unique and challenging. You know, it's challenging. I think General Assembly showed both the beauty and the challenges. But I think it's a worthwhile thing for us to do and to be. And so I'm hopeful. I'm excited to learn in travels and experiencing the global church and what God is doing there. But I really want to advocate for us and work at us continuing to be that globally connected church. And we're already in the process of doing this. We can look back in our history and realize we were really a North American dominated church reaching out graciously and trying to do missions in other parts of the world. But I do think we've reached this moment where it's not just what does the North American and European church have to share with the world, but now almost in reverse, what does the global church have to teach the North American church and the European church? And I want to learn that, first of all, but I also want to be an advocate for what that may look like for us and how that may, what we may learn from each other in these moments.
Well, thank you, Dr. Daniels. It's been great. So it was a good time sharing this conversation with you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to the Holiness Today podcast. If you enjoyed this production and wish to hear more, visit holinesstoday.org/podcast or find us on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts.